thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Hunting Public Podcast. It's been an eventful week of hunting during late October through Halloween, and now these first couple days of November. So on today's show, we're going to try to answer as many viewer questions as possible about what people are seeing in the field, talk about what we've been seeing as far as buck encounters go, and revisit our shot selection topic that we discussed on the previous show. So it should be a good one. I hope you enjoy it. We are live on Facebook and Instagram, and this is going to be a short podcast today, Greg.
Got to get out in the field.
We have got to get back to the woods. Things are going crazy right now. We're seeing bucks, and we probably shouldn't be here right now, but we had to come in, charge batteries, grab a bite to eat, so we figured we'd do a quick half-hour podcast here over lunch. We got a lot to cover today, so let's get right into it. And any of you that have questions or comments about your situations, please comment as we go, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can. It just, we're not going to have quite as much time on today's episode, but it's been an eventful week. You filmed Luke shoot a giant buck
had
just
an incredible
a couple
hunt,
days ago.
Incredible hunt on November 1st. Halloween, I had a fairly eventful hunt in the evening, and then going back to your hunts in Missouri, been very eventful as well. So, keeps getting better and better.
Yeah. Movement really started picking up. I guess it was kind of gradual. I mean, we had, what was that, about a week ago with that encounter with that buck with you, Brody.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we were seeing bucks on the private land then. Scott Pruke almost killed a nice buck. And then leading right up into Halloween, things just sort of built, you know. And our hunting strategy, I don't think, has really changed much. But I thought it was interesting where Luke killed that buck. You know, he was running a lot of trail cameras in that cedar thicket in that area, and there was tons and tons of bucks in there, and he's been picking them up on camera there all month in October.
Yeah, running trail cameras on scrapes close to bedding. He's got two or three different cameras positioned around this cedar thicket where these bucks are spending a lot of their time, and just eventually, really, it occurred in a short amount of time. He knew about the deer on October 27th. For the first time is when he knew about him.
Right.
And then hunted it a couple different times, encountered the deer on the 28th, I believe, when he was a full draw twice on him. So anyways, he learned a lot of information quickly by checking these cameras on scrapes. And we went in there and hunted on the 1st, checked the cameras after the morning hunt. And even in that short amount of time, we noticed a decrease in the amount of activity on scrapes going into the 1st of November there.
Sure.
Like his best opportunity to kill that buck specifically right on one of those scrapes seemed like it would have been around the 25th, 22nd, 24th, 26th, 27th, like almost every day that buck was on a scrape during daylight.
What was interesting though is the way that he runs those cameras. He's running them on basically bedding area scrapes, the ones that are right next to the bedding area. And those cameras allowed him to figure out where this buck was living at, because he started getting all these daylight photos of this deer coming in, and knew that he had to be living just right there near those camera sites. So he was hunting right there near those scrapes. Sometimes he was hunting the scrape itself, but where you all killed the deer was it was in that bedding area.
Yeah,
it just wasn't over.
Just off the edge of it.
Right.
And I mean, if you watch the video, he goes into pretty good detail about his process for checking these cameras, learning where the buck was at. But, you know, by running multiple cameras, he was able to pick up the deer, you know, I think at least once or twice on the same day, and was able to kind of get this point A, point B, and, you know, a certain amount of time went by between those pictures on those scrapes. But he was getting an idea of what trails the buck was using to get from one scrape to the other.
Yeah, so and we talk about that all the time, about daylight movement on trail cameras and what it means. And more times than not, when you have a buck consistently showing up in daylight, especially in October, he's living very close to that camera.
Yeah.
He's living and bedding very close to that.
Right.
And what we've noticed the last few days of October and the first few days of November is those bucks are still there, those mature bucks.
Yeah.
Like, they haven't got up and are traveling miles and miles down the road, it doesn't seem. It seems like they're still in those core areas that they were in throughout most of the month of October.
Right. And
they're just becoming more active within those areas.
And he was. And Luke went in and hunted, you know, he's I think he's going to be busy harvesting crops and planting cover crops. So he knew his amount, his time, his hunting time was going to be very limited
right.
coming up here. So he decided to get aggressive before it got too far into November to where that buck, yeah, started, you know, maybe picked up a hot doe, you know, ranged off the property. You know, he was still right in there, and we are quite certain that he was bedded close by to where we were at, to the point where Luke blind grunted.
Yeah, 2:45 or 2:45
in the afternoon. So we believe, and it makes sense the way the property lays out. And there's a cedar thicket, and then it, there's a the ridge that goes back up.
Right.
And it was a east southeast wind that day, and you know, it would have made sense for him to be bedded somewhere back in there with the wind, you know, blowing over back, and that he would have been bedded or at least, or up on his feet close by enough to where he could hear that grunt call and then came out to the edge of the pasture to investigate.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. If y'all haven't seen that video yet, it's pretty compelling. You need to check it out. I also, the day before that, had a really awesome sit in Missouri.
Yeah, Halloween was good.
It did ended up not being so awesome, but we'll get to that in a minute. We were sitting on public land in Missouri, and it was the same type of scenario. You know, I'd been down there scouting and hunting this river bottom for the last few weeks, just here and there. I'm not able to go to Missouri all the time like we are in Iowa. We can just run down the road up here to go scout or go hunt. Down there, I went down and would just have a day or 2 days at a time to kind of scout and hunt. And I found a buck bedding area by reading a lot of sign in mid-October and went back in to hunt the edge of that bedding area on Halloween morning, myself and Jake did. And we hung the set in the dark, and we ended up seeing like 5 bucks, 2 shooters within 30 yards of the stand. And that that video journal is also up right now. Unfortunately, I made a bad shot on one of those deer, and or a bad hit, and wasn't able to find him. I think it was a non-lethal hit, so that is a good thing.
It certainly looked like it.
But yeah, we were just touching on shot selection.
So maybe before we get to shot selection, you know, you talk about these trips you've made to Missouri. How much time have you spent kind of scouting observation sits compared to actual time in a, you know, in a,
that's a question
like in a kill spot?
That's a question we do get asked quite a bit. And I've been down to Missouri about 5 different times, 5 different hunts, I guess. But I've spent 50% of those hunts, 2 or 3 of them anyway, just observing.
Right.
Or just scouting. You know,
so instead of just diving in on a whim, you spent
a good amount of time observing. I didn't have the luxury of trail cameras in this spot, so but what I did have, the advantage there was that the bedding cover was only about chest high, and when they stand up, you can visually see them stand up and then move from there. So that's what I've been doing most of the month of October. I've been pecking around the edges of that bedding area and glassing in there to kind of see where these bucks were at, and I went. One night I went in there, obviously I took my bow, I sat up on the ground, and I observed a couple of good bucks stand up out there in the bedding. I also scouted and found a bunch of huge rubs leading up into the cedar thicket. You know, it's kind of multiple buck bedding areas in one little area. You know, there's little pockets of bedding that are interconnected within, say, 25 acres or so.
Yeah.
And that's what Jake and I were going in to hunt that morning, and because of the increased activity that Halloween brings, these bucks were getting back to that bedding area later in the morning. Mm-hmm. And that's why we were able to see them and get a shot at them. Whereas if it had been mid-October, there's a good chance they'd already been in the bedding area. You know, and even as we were hanging the stands, in the dark, we could hear a buck up in the bedding making a rub or a scrape. I mean, you could hear him up in there and his antlers tinkling on stuff. And yeah, eventually we saw some good deer that morning, but
I guess what I was trying to bring out is just the importance of scouting and observation as opposed to just diving in, you know, on those short little hunts.
Right.
You know, I think that's something that a lot of people can relate to. You know, traveling somewhere to hunt, they only have a certain amount of time. Like, how much time should you spend, you know, scouting versus just going in on a whim?
Right, and that's what we do very often. You'll also notice in Luke's hunt, he killed this buck on a hanging hunt. The deer was caught off guard.
Right.
You know, he's coming in to, possibly coming into the sound of that grunt call, but he's not seen a stand in that tree before. He's likely not smelled somebody in or around that tree before.
Looks like he's never hunted that spot.
He's never hunted that spot on the farm before. And you hear that over and over again, and that's what happens to us all the time on public land. And the same thing happened on that Halloween hunt that we're talking about that I had the other day. We packed in stands in the dark and set up, had never been in there. We'd only observed it from a distance. And we're super aggressive. We talk about that style a lot, but what we're preaching when we're being aggressive is going in for the kill. Like, you lay back either with cameras or with observation sits or scouting or whatever until the conditions are right to go in there for the kill. And when we do, we go in as far as need be.
Yeah.
You know, or we stage hunt it, kind of. We hunt it in sections. We'll start at the outskirt, hunt the first spot, maybe an observation stand, then push in a little bit farther, and then push in a little bit farther. But every time we're hunting a different tree.
Right.
So basically, if you have, you know, just a few days of vacation and you're taking your rut vacations, 5 days, you could use this Missouri hunt as an example. Go down, observe for a couple days, pick the tree from a distance, see kind of where those bucks are going. And then Jake and I went in there, hung it in the dark, gave ourselves plenty of time to get in because there was deer around the stand. Like, we had to wait a good 45 minutes before we could go up to the tree that we wanted to hunt out of to hang because there was deer moving around up there.
Sure.
So we waited for them to move off and went in there and hung the stand. And, you know, if hindsight's 20/20, obviously, but we should have had two bucks. You know, Jake and I each have Missouri tags now. At the time, I just had a tag, and I hit that first deer. And then an hour later, another big shooter buck comes right through the opening, straight to 10 yards. So just goes to show you, you know.
The outcome was unfortunate.
The outcome was,
but yes. The process was perfect.
Yeah.
You know, between from scouting to finding the right spot, getting in there early, getting the stand set up, and you guys had two shooter bucks.
Right.
Within range.
Really should have killed two bucks in the same morning out of the same tree. You know, and we have that happen to us a lot on public, on these hunts, doing it this way. You know, we sort of pick our moves on all these areas. And once we feel good about a general spot and on a specific day with certain conditions like that, we'll go right in and set up. And many times that's the outcome. I mean, a lot of times you're wrong, but all you have to do on sits like that, where you're going right into the bedroom with them, all you have to do is be right once during the season, and there's your opportunity. I mean, I had two of them in the same morning. I couldn't shoot the second one because I already had an arrow in the first one, you know. But
okay. Do we have any questions we move on to the shot?
Yep. I have a particular buck coming from a property I can't hunt. I know they have their bedding in there. So coming from beds across the road to the standing bean field, you can't hang a stand there. There is a drainage running through the field. Do you think I should sit in that drainage with a decoy drawn closer? You can only bow hunt the property.
And
the from the bed, which is east, to food, which is west.
Right, east to west. Yeah, you want to, if you can hunt it on a cooler evening, that could help. But I mean, today, if I'm not mistaken, it's an east wind. The bedding is east.
Yes, I believe so.
And the food is west. I don't know where he's located at or where this person is located at. But if you've got an easterly wind today, yeah, go get in that waterway or that ditch or whatever and put a decoy out there. Yeah.
I love that idea.
Yeah, it sounds like you've already got the plan. Just go in there and give it a try, you know. Got nothing to lose if they're bedded on the neighbor next door. You can get away with bumping them off of food sources more than you can getting away with bumping them out of bedding. You know, so definitely.
Yeah, that sounds like a great plan.
What else you got? Anything else?
What's your opinions on cold calling or rattling on public?
Like blind calling?
Blind calling?
Yeah. We don't do it very often.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of any deer that we've harvested as a result of that. We've called deer in that we've seen. I have to think back a little bit.
I almost killed one a couple years ago with Michael Parente. Rattled him in right at dark, but here's what happened. It was right before dark, and I thought the stand was set up perfect for calling. So I rattled, looked down 10 seconds later, and a big buck is coming down the transition. And he ends up coming to 30 yards, but right where he gets into almost to my opening where I can shoot, he gets my wind. Yep. And that happens all the time when you're blind calling. because that deer is, if it's a mature buck for your area, he's going to go downwind of the sound almost every time without fail. So we were talking this morning, though, when we were set up in the open gate stand, our wind for the first hour or so was actually rising a little bit, and it would have been really hard for any deer around the stand to smell us.
Yeah, and I think we were going to blind call at that point, but we had does close by, and we didn't want to call loud and spook them. But yeah, that's in that situation, it would have been perfect because the thermals were lifting our scent up to where a buck could have got downwind.
Calling is very situational. When it comes to blind calling, it's very situational. Like that, what we're discussing here, we had a brief window this morning where we could have blind called in this bedding area and not had a deer come in and smell us. You know, and then you're not harming much. If he comes in and he doesn't close all the way into bow range, he's going to look up there, not see the deer that he was looking for, and probably turn around and go back, and you're no worse for the wear. But if he comes in and he smells you out of that tree stand, then you may be done on that deer out of that tree stand.
Yeah.
And
I guess he mentioned hunting on public land. You know, if you're bouncing around more, maybe it's a little bit. But if you've got a stand that you like to hunt over and over again and you get busted by a mature buck that, you know, that comes into your calling, probably unlikely he's coming by that stand again unless a hot doe pulls him by.
Calling definitely works, but usually when we see the deer or we've got a decoy that we're using in conjunction with it.
Yeah, we don't blind call a lot.
Very rarely.
Very little.
Yeah.
Okay, real quick question here. Do the private land guys have exclusive access, or do they share the property with others?
I believe this property where Luke is hunting down there is pretty small, and he actually has, there's other people that hunt that land as well.
Yep, that's shared, and there's other people that hunt close by there. In fact, we heard a guy rattling and grunting just across the fence line as we were recovering that buck.
Yeah, so I mean, it's private land, but it's something that everybody's dealing with out there. You know, I mean, it's a small parcel. I mean, that one spot Luke and I hunted a week or two ago when we saw a nice buck is just a little like 10-acre woodlot, and that's really all it is. That's the whole property. You know, and he's got one tree stand on it. But those places can hold big bucks, obviously, you know, and that's what makes the hunt really cool.
I think that was another reason why Luke got a little more aggressive on this deer.
It's
just because
people.
I mean, as we get into November, you know, bucks are going to start traveling more, and I mean, it's a relatively small property to begin with, so there was a good likelihood that deer could have got shot, you know, by another hunter on another property. So it was, you know, he had to strike and strike quickly,
right?
And it worked.
Yeah. Anything else before we move on, Brady?
Someone on Instagram wants to know, said, what should they do right now? They said, I'm in the stand with an east wind, and I saw a buck go into bedding west of me.
Ooh. Boy, that's tough. So his wind is blowing into that bedding area.
I wonder if he can get out around.
Yeah, if
he's mobile. I wonder if he could make some kind of move.
Yeah, that would probably be ideal if you were mobile and you could move possibly to a corner of the bedding area where you're hunting it with a just off wind instead of your wind blowing straight into it. Unless, I mean, if he went in there with that wind, you know, I don't know. It could be an east wind, but at that tree that he's sitting in, it may be doing something completely different. This morning was a northeast wind for Greg and I, and for the first 2 hours of the morning, it was blowing our scent from the southeast, you know, because of the way that the wind swirls and stuff in these areas, and that could be the same situation. I don't know. That's a hard one. That's a hard one there. If he went in by himself and he wasn't alarmed, then his wind may not actually be blowing into that bedding area. No. And he may come right back out of there again. I don't know. The same thing happened to me two mornings ago in Missouri. We watched a buck and doe, a shooter buck, go into bedding about 10 a.m. And we actually moved the stand about 80 yards closer to them. And the doe came out that night, walked right past the stand, but the buck didn't follow her. You know, just happenstance. He very well could have, but in this situation, he didn't. We were hunting that doe, and she came out, but the buck wasn't with her. So, yeah. Just got to play it by ear.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to get aggressive right now. That's the thing. especially when you've got these day winds in the middle of the day like this, when the wind's getting up around 15 miles an hour or so and these deer are laying down, you can get away with a lot moving in really tight to them if that's the route that you decide to go. Good on questions good. For now?
Yep. Jake says he wants to know if your friends get married on the 4th, should you get new friends?
Yes.
Jake's up at a wedding right now in Wisconsin, and I don't know how happy he is. But, yeah, it'll still be fun for you, man. We'll be in the tree thinking about you. But we'll touch on the shot selection real briefly. Anybody that watched my hunt from Halloween a couple days ago, when Greg and I were just talking about it, you'll see that I hit and lose a really nice buck in Missouri. And I wanted to just kind of discuss a little more about what my thought process was with the shot and kind of what happened there, I guess. The buck came in and he was, if you're watching the video, he actually comes in behind a tree and I come to full draw when he's behind that tree and he's 31 yards. And if he comes all the way around the tree, like I'm anticipating him to do, he's going to be at about 28 yards broadside, which is the ideal shot in that situation for me. I'm drawn back, but the deer actually hits our ground scent and turns and walks back the way that he came from. And when he pops out on the other side of the tree, he's actually quartering to me slightly. So my initial thought was, okay, he's quartering to me. When he clears that foreleg, when he moves that foreleg and takes a step, I'm going to stop him, and I'm going to try to shoot tight to the shoulder. You know, he's got the foreleg open in his vitals. He's slightly quartering to. I figured at 30 yards, I could slide it in there and get him right behind the shoulder and go up in there. What happened, though, is when he took one step, he went from slightly quartering to completely broadside. And that's just how these deer, I mean, they come in at funny angles. We talk about it all the time. And the further away they are, the harder it is for you to judge that angle.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation, I could only see about half of the deer's body, you know, until he took that last step where I had to shoot. And that's another big thing. I'm shooting down through a bunch of trees. I could not see the entire deer's body to really read his body language and tell which angle he was standing at. He went from slightly quartering to straight broadside, and I was still shooting him for slightly quartering two. And I played for the duck. You know, I had the 20-yard pin dead center on his lungs for a 30-yard shot.
So your 30 was?
My 30 was on his heart, basically.
His heart, yeah.
Just slightly forward of the heart, like at the front of the heart, back of the shoulder right there, because I thought he was slightly quartering two. And when I shot, you'll see in the video how much the deer ducks. You know, I mean, it's nearly 10 inches to a foot, and it hits him high and in front of the shoulder because he's actually ducking and wheeling at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't think it was a fatal hit. I mean, Jake and I watched the deer for 20 minutes after that.
Yeah.
You know, just slowly walking off and did not act hurt at all and then didn't find much for blood. But, you know, I'm sure there's more that we can take away from that. Me personally, that's like my maximum range. I don't like shooting past 30.
Right.
I haven't hit and lost one in a long time. And the last one I did, it was a 30-yard shot, similar situation, where the deer moved a ton. And I felt like, you know, after watching the slow-motion footage, the only way that I could have ethically killed that deer with a double-lung shot is if I'd have aimed, you know, 20-yard pin on a 30-yard shot at the bottom of his belly almost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that would have hit him right above the heart, double lungs.
Yeah.
And 5 inches back from the shoulder. But I don't know. What'd you think looking at it?
That's a tough situation.
I mean, I thought of that. I made a mistake. I missed.
Yeah, that's a tough situation. Like, and once you get to full draw, once you're anticipating that shot opportunity, you know, you're talking about being able to read the deer's body language. It's such an unpredictable it's a tough distance because of the unpredictability of how far they're going to drop. But when they're alert like that, you know, do you think you could have just let down and not taken the shot? Like, were you at the point where the shot?
Yeah, and he had.
I guess did it cross your mind that maybe I should just let down and not take the shot because he was alert?
Yes, it did. Very briefly. But I knew also at that time he had does and fawns coming in back behind him. And I just told Jake, I'm like, this is going to be a rodeo. And I said, he's going to have to get to 30 yards before I take a shot. And he, and when he got behind that tree was 28 yards. He was right behind it. So I figured when he cleared that tree, he'd be just inside of 30. So I was at full draw, and the only, and when he was slightly quartering too, I was like, nope, I'm not taking that. It's like the only way, that's when it hit me in my mind, is that in that brief second, when he was slightly quartering too, I was thinking to myself, the only way I shoot this deer is if he moves that foreleg forward and he stops and exposes those vitals. And he did, and I grounded real soft to stop him, and he stopped perfect. Except I was still shooting him for slightly quartering too. And if I had shot him for straight broadside, I might have had more luck killing the deer. But at the same time, I wish I had the arrow back because of the amount that he moved. And it just, I've always said that that's my maximum range. And maybe I need to bring that in even further. You know, I'm completely confident in shooting at targets 30, 40 yards, no problem. But how do you know if the deer's going to drop 4 inches? How do you know if he's going to drop 12 inches? Yeah. You know, you talked about reading his body language and reading the angle is harder at that distance. In hindsight, I shouldn't have took it. I should have just let down. But what would have happened at that point? I grunted to stop the deer. Once you do that, you know, then all those eyes look over there, and that's it. It wasn't one of those deals where if he would have stopped on his own right there and I wouldn't have grunted at him and I didn't feel confident in the angle, I would have let down. Mm-hmm. And I would have been, okay, maybe we can get another chance. But at that point that I grunted, when he cleared that leg, it's like, this is it or it's not happening.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd already held it for quite a while. You know, looking back at it, though, I would not have taken it.
Yeah.
You know, and especially what happened 30 minutes later when that other shooter walked into 10 yards, you know, chip shot. But because those are the opportunities that I hang the stands for, you know, was what that second buck did. Walk right down the pipe and turn and be broadside at 10 steps and not even know that we're in the world. Those are the ones that you want when you're bow hunting, not the 30 yarders. I definitely didn't hang the stand for that shot. You know, but he picked that ground scent up, and that was just enough to kind of turn him. But lessons learned.
Tough lesson learned. Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of experience and a lot of discipline to recognize those situations where, you know, if a deer is alert at 30 yards, you know it's going to duck. And
I still shot for it.
It's not a high odds shot. No.
You can watch that video and see how much that deer moves and where you've got to put your pin to really nail him. And if I'd have came off of the shoulder a little ways, I would have been better off. But I think I still would have hit the shoulder. Yeah. And maybe with my setup, it goes through there. But with most folks, they hit the center of that shoulder 30 yards and you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Like you don't want to be messing with that thing at all. And to hit behind the shoulder, I mean, you can actually watch the deer's full broadside. He's actually got that foreleg cleared, so his vitals are as exposed as they're gonna get, and he goes from that in a few milliseconds.
Yep.
He goes from that to ducking about a foot and wheeling away. And when he ducks, he locks those legs. And when he locks those legs, that foreleg and that fore shoulder actually come back and cover most of his vitals.
Mm.
So when you look at him upon impact of the arrow, most of his vitals are covered by that shoulder because he's locked his legs and he's getting ready to take off.
Sure.
You know, he just went from a perfectly exposed broadside shot to an extremely difficult angle, and just like that, the time that the arrow left the bow and that it got to him.
Hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, it just, you got to take extreme caution in those shots past 20, 25 yards. I mean, even 25 yards. Need to be real careful.
People kill deer at 30 yards all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But as we said, you know, a 30-yard shot at a fully alert deer is a high-risk shot, you know, low-odd shot that, you know, if you have the discipline to avoid it, avoid it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I should have never even grunted to stop him. I had him in a wide open spot.
Yep. That was another thought I had, is if you just would have shot him as he moved that leg forward. Or just,
I could have done that, and he probably would have been toast. You know, there's a lot of things. And when it happens that fast, it's just hard to judge. The thing that is not hard is that second buck that came in. When that second buck is coming in, I'm thinking in my mind this whole time, you know, like going through the thought process of a shot, although I'm not shooting, obviously. Come to full draw behind the tree, and he comes out behind the tree, and he slowly works in to 10 yards. And I'm thinking about all the different shot opportunities I've got on this deer's trail. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even have to stop this thing.
Yeah.
He's 10 yards, and I'm on him and following him in the wide open. That's such a – you're comparing apples to oranges when you're talking about that shot compared to that 30-yard shot that I took earlier that morning. The difficulty level is so much more at that 30-yard shot than that 12-yard shot or that 10-yard shot on that second buck that comes in. And that's why – that's what we were preaching about in the shot selection thing, and that's why I said 30 yards is my max range. I may have to even bring that in a little bit more.
Yeah.
But your odds just go up so much more when you have them in that good ethical kill distance of 10 to 15 yards. What'd you say this morning, 14 yards was your average?
Oh, yeah. I was telling Aaron that back in high school when I got bored during class, I would add up the yardages of all the deer that I had shot over the years, and it was – you know, usually came out to around 14, 15 yards. It was like kind of like my running average.
Yeah.
And I think I also said that I could probably count on one hand the number of deer that I've killed past 30 yards.
Right.
You know, most of the shots are 10 to 25.
Same with me. It's most of them are 10 to 25. I mean, the vast majority of the bucks that I've killed, or does for that matter, been at those distances. I've killed a couple of deer 30 and 35 yards. But, you know, I think about it, and I'm probably 50% on those shots taken at 30 yards or further. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's not good at all.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody is of a high percentage on those types of shots, just because it's of the uncontrollable factors that can happen from the time that your arrow leaves the bow. When they get in there to 10, 15 steps in the wide open, they're in trouble.
No brainer.
I mean, it's... There's stuff that can obviously still go wrong, but that margin of error is so much larger at those close ranges than it is out there a ways. But hard lesson.
Yep.
Hard lesson. We got any more questions? We got to wrap this up pretty quick and go to the woods, Brody.
If you're leaving your stand in the dark and you get blown at, how do you prevent or react?
It happened to us this morning.
Going into the stand.
Okay.
He's talking about leaving the stand, I believe.
Yep.
Leaving the stand.
How do you prevent that? I guess one way is using headlamps.
Yeah, that's what we do.
That's helped.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, I grew up not using a headlamp a lot because I just didn't want to, you know, I just felt like light shining is like, you know, and I don't need a headlamp to navigate my way through the woods, so I never really used one. And then I started seeing the amount of success you guys were having using them on public land, you know, being able to navigate past deer in the dark, you know, where they're coming or going. So that, I guess that would be one way, is using a headlamp.
Yeah, it helps you be so much quieter and more calculated with all your movements. You think about when a deer picks up on you and it spooks, especially from sound. If you're making that consistent crunch, crunch, crunch out of the woods in the evening, those deer are going to know that something is wrong. But if you're using that headlamp and you're tiptoeing out of there, and if you accidentally break a twig, for instance, and you stop and just stand there for a few minutes, they're going to go right back to what they're doing. If you watch and observe a bedded deer, listen to the sounds in the woods, you'll see them, you know, whenever a squirrel breaks a twig or a branch or whatever, you'll see them whip that head over there and look that direction for a few seconds. But then they give up on it. If they didn't give up on it, then they would stare at this stuff all day long and they would never move anywhere or do anything. They eventually give up on that sound, and that's why, that's what can aid you in getting out, you know. But sometimes you're just going to blow deer.
Yeah, sometimes it's unavoidable.
And I don't know that it necessarily affects them that much. I mean, they may blow and take off out of there, and you may think you just, you know, screwed the pooch on that stand, but... many times they have no idea what you are, and they're blowing because of that, and they're getting out of there, and they'll be back the next day. You just don't know. You know, if they see you in the tree and smell you in the tree at the same time, you're in trouble. But if you're climbing down or moving away from the stand and you bump a deer to distance and it takes off blowing, don't necessarily think that you've just spooked it onto the next property, because that's probably not the case. No. Got any more?
One more. Just, what are you guys wearing for like base layers and stuff when it's cold out? It says it's affecting like his draw and his bow.
I don't know. It depends on whatever we got that day.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, our hunting clothes are pretty much all ripped to shreds.
I got a Mizzou t-shirt on under this, and then this old scent lock base layers that hasn't been washed in just years probably. But I just wear a jacket over this.
So he's having trouble.
Yeah, says it's
wearing heavy.
Bundling up so much makes my draw length shorter.
Put your safety harness on the outside of your jacket. That may help, and then stretch and then
some
pull it down tight, and it'll pull that stuff in so that you can come more across your chest with your draw. That may assist somewhat. But yeah.
Yep, that's it.
Okay.
All right.
We've got to get to the woods, folks. Thanks for joining us today. And if we missed any questions during the podcast, we'll try to answer them in the comments. Good luck to everybody hunting. Now is the time to be in the woods.
Absolutely.
So quit listening to us and go hunt.
Go get out there.